Last week I brought up some impressions from this recent trip to Kathmandu, and just thinking today about that a little more, I thought of this one teaching from this retreat I did with my teacher Soknyi Rinpoche. While I was there, he taught a text on non-dual meditation, particularly written for what the author of the 1800s, Tibetan author of this text, called town yogis. It's a teaching for town yogis. I think that's kind of like us. As opposed to mountain yogis, cave-dwelling yogis, monastery, cloistered yogis, town yogis, live in town. They go to work in the morning. They go shopping in the afternoon. And they are too busy. And they want to practice meditation. That's why they're yogis. There's town people and there's town yogis, right? So this wonderful, profound teaching that that my teacher presented was written for town yogis. I think the kind of introductory paragraphs is something like, for those who wish to practice authentically and realize the nature of mind, Buddha nature, but without spending a lot of time and effort and strenuous exertion, kind of like the simple, maybe easy path. For people who want that, he taught this. And I think kind of commenting on that section, the teacher presenting it brought up what he called two kinds of renunciation. Low class and high class renunciation. We need renunciation. We need to be able to let go of whatever we're holding on to and be free. It's kind of like a, you know, basic foundation of the path of freedom. We could even say renunciation is freedom. Renunciation just means to renounce, to let go of what we're holding on to. And so, kind of a loaded word in English, I think. And I think the loaded version of it is what he's referring to as low-class renunciation. Like when we feel like we in order to really practice, we have to go to the monastery or go to the mountains, live in a cave or something. Because we can't actually practice renunciation right here and now, we need these like better conditions. I can't really practice here because it's too distracting and it's too busy and there's too many, you know, things in my life that make really letting go impossible. I have too many responsibilities. Yeah. I think we can often feel this way. I have often felt this way. Many years living in the mountain monastery at Tassajara, I would feel this way, that it was too distracting living there, and I had to go deeper into the mountains or be alone, because mostly what distractions are are other people and all their, you know, requests of us and annoyances they create, don't they? So low-class renunciation is to think, I really do want to practice renunciation, and eventually I'll be able to when the conditions are right, and I set it all up like that, and go into retreat. Even here we might feel like, well, I can really let go when we have sesshin, and we have lots of them. So I'll wait till that time. In the meanwhile, I have to be totally obsessed and busy, because that's what I have to do, right? I'm a town yogi, after all. So thinking that we have to do it in some future time when the conditions are better, and also that kind of goes along with blaming the conditions, the current conditions, which are often other people. I'd practice renunciation if it weren't for you in my life. So, still maybe it, the spirit is in the general right direction. I mean, we at least want to practice. We at least know that letting go is a way towards freedom and ease. But it's what Sogyen Rinpoche called low-class renunciation. High-class renunciation, as you might imagine, is to just let go right here and now, wherever you are in the midst of your totally busy, chaotic life. Just drop it. Just find a way to find some ease in the middle of your busy situation, which, without actually removing the busy situation. High class is, you know, means maybe like a little harder in a way. The Buddha created monasteries and secluded practice places because it helps. It makes it easier to let go. But really high class, like, you know, strong practice, if we really have such a strong intention, possible to do anywhere. With no blame and no regret, let go, right in the middle of it all. One teaching that Sogyen Rinpoche brought up in this retreat over and over again was the practice of saying, so what? I think this is, you know, high class renunciation practice you could apply virtually any time. With whatever's arising in your experience, good or bad, you know, I think it first came up in the discussion about how can you discern exactly what this non-dual mind of meditation is. We have to clarify this, right? In the end, you know, when it comes right down to it, best to say, so what? It might not be. It might not be the authentic thing. And then what if I'm off track? You just say, so what? And you kind of enter it at that time. You know, when things are going quite well, but you maybe have some doubt. Or if you just lose everything, your huge investment in totally loses all its value and you go bankrupt. Maybe quite hard to say, so what? But how wonderful if we could, right? And we're allowed to say, so what? And
yes.
So what? what? So one practice.
So what?
So extremely what? My practice may be not going so well. This talk may not be going so well. So what? So we have, you know, lots of practices to practice in the spirit of so what, and the spirit of high class renunciation, of letting go and being free. Another thought I had today was that arose from somewhere was, is this practice about feeling happy, or is it about being free? I think we often confuse them. You know, well, if I'm not happy, I must not be working. But I don't think it's actually really about feeling happy. We might often feel happy when practice is going well. I think that does happen, which is, I think, why we confuse them. If we take that as the sign that it's going well, I feel really happy and at ease and comfortable and relaxed, and my energy is flowing well, and there are all these are all wonderful side effects of Zen practice. But when looking more deeply into it, I have the sense that it's really more about being free in the midst of whatever's happening, which may not be happiness. We may be like really be physically in pain or emotionally sad or angry or dull or distracted, but can we be free in the middle of that? And, you know, we might even ask, maybe that would be a kind of koan, is that happiness? If you're free, if there's a kind of like easeful holding of a state of anger or depression, is that, do we call that happiness? Maybe not, or maybe, but there's some freedom there. It's kind of like, okay, it's kind of when we say, yeah, I'm like really upset now, and really, I feel really stressed, but so what? So how to practice in a way to open up this freedom that doesn't depend or result in happiness necessarily. So this, I have proposed that 2013 be a year to study mirror awareness. So there's many practices, but this is one we can look at in depth this year. Mirror mind. Awareness that reflects like a mirror. And we have many Zen teachings about this, like the song of the jewel mirror, samadhi, and Dogen's teaching on the ancient mirror, and various stories about polishing tiles to create mirrors, and wiping dust off mirrors, or noticing if there is any dust on mirrors. So this kind of image, this metaphor, keeps cropping up throughout Zen history. And I think it's a great really metaphor or image to examine the nature of mind. And in many ways, quite straightforward. You know, a mirror is like, basically, it just receives whatever object is placed before it. It just receives the image of that object, kind of like neutrally. It basically has no opinions about the object. Like the mirror doesn't prefer like certain colors. There, I wish I could reflect blue today. Why is it so red? It's like mirrors aren't like that, right? They don't discriminate at all amongst the objects placed before them, and yet they don't like block them out or alter them or anything. They just perfectly reflect back what's placed before them in this non-discriminating kind of way, non-preferential kind of way. think that's the main thing about mirrors. The main practice of mirrors is to just non-preferentially reflect whatever is placed before them. And also a nice thing about mirrors is when you try to look at the mirror directly, you basically, all you see is your reflection, right? You can't actually see like the surface of the mirror, a nice shiny mirror. If there's a smudge or something on it, then maybe that you can see where the reflection is. But mirrors are kind of strange in that way. You can't really see exactly where it begins, the more clear it is especially. So you can't see it itself. If you try to kind of get a hold of it, all you get a hold of is the image on it. And the image that's reflected on it is it's just an image. It's just a illusory appearance. So it whatever is placed before the mirror, it just the mirror shows a kind of illusory image of the object. So the things in the mirror don't stick to the mirror. So the mirror doesn't have like a kind of lag time when you put something in front of it and you take it away. It doesn't stay there for a minute and then slowly leave. Just immediately, you know, red, okay, now blue. It's like there's no hesitation. The mirror spontaneously and instantly, flexibly changes to the next image. It doesn't say, just a little bit longer with the blue. We're going to reflect the blue a little longer before it disappears. It's just immediate response. So all these qualities of the mirror are, make it a wonderful metaphor for the mind of Zazen. We're just sitting, and whatever our practice might be, whether it's following the breath, awareness of the body, awareness of whatever sensory activity is happening, awareness of thoughts arising or no thoughts arising. Meanwhile, there's this mirror-like awareness that's always present. And we could call Buddha nature. It's empty. When nothing's placed in front of it, it's just, you can't even see it. There's nothing there, right? It's completely empty, and yet it reflects all these appearances effortlessly and non-discriminately. So it's clearly aware, and yet it doesn't grasp anything at all. And it doesn't contain any objects or images in itself. They're just reflected off it. So that's kind of like this spacious background mind. Maybe say the nature of mind. We have our discriminating mind that prefers blue over red and wants to perceive it a little bit longer and conceptualizes all about it, distorting all our direct perceptions into elaborate conceptual versions of things. That's our discriminating mind on the surface, we're very familiar with, operating almost all the time. But at the very same time, always, no matter how totally distracted we are, the teaching is that there's this open, spacious, non-discriminating awareness, just observing, just receiving what's happening. Always. And I think through this metaphor, during Zazen, we can kind of like open to that mirror aspect of awareness. It's kind of like, again, if we try to look directly at it, like get a hold of the mirror, like there it is, the mirror awareness. Nice thing about a mirror, you can't do that, right? You're just going to see your ideas of it reflected in it. And yet you can kind of like, you can, maybe another way to say it is, instead of like trying to see the mirror and kind of get a hold of what it is, we could say the practice is to just be the mirror. Just be the mirror. If you try to like be the mirror and kind of like figure out what the mirror is, then you know that distorts the vision of the mirror. So we just reflect. And in Zazen, it's like all the senses. You know, part of the problem with the mirror metaphor is it's very visual oriented. And I think it's nice we can approach it that way. Like, here's an object, a visual object. Let's see if we can just reflect it without adding anything extra or any preference about it. But all the other senses are also the objects of all the senses can be reflected in this mirror mind. So sounds come, we just reflect the sounds, smells, tastes, touches, you know, physical sensations while we're sitting. All of those are like the reflections in the mirror. And thoughts, emotions, all of mental activity also. Maybe the most distracting or thoughts and emotions, I think much more than sensory objects, really pull us away from noticing that mirror mind. We're so caught up in them that we forget that background awareness. Background is another metaphor. It's not, there's no location, but it's almost sometimes, visualize it as kind of like, it's like this big kind of sphere behind us or containing us in a way. And we can learn that backward step. And instead of going forward into objects, back up and notice, oh, there's this kind of spacious awareness that holds our whole experience. It was almost like there's this body that's seeing and hearing and talking and sitting here, and the whole thing is being held by this very kind and compassionate, are some other qualities of this mirror awareness. Neutrally just observing. Oh, look, there's little Kokyo sitting on the seat and talking. I have no opinions about him at all. He has opinions about himself. But I just say, so what? The mirror is saying, so what? I propose that this is actually being that mirror is what our ancestor Dzogchen is talking about when he refers to the jewel mirror samadhi. He greatly elaborates on the functions of this mirror in this quite difficult poem, but I think it's quite basic function of this mirror. And also another nice thing about the mirror is that it it doesn't need to be, this isn't just sitting meditation in the Zendo practice. The mirror, you happen to be taking it wherever you go. You never can leave home without it. It's always available in the busiest, most chaotic situation. You can always like just step back and meanwhile, sometimes maybe even more noticeable when it's like we're really anxious or something and we just remember to look. It's a little bit like looking back, but not seeing the mirror exactly, but almost like appreciating that compassionate, spacious awareness that's holding our little anxious experience. I was trying to do this today as I was rushing back from farmer's market late as usual and like feeling like, okay, come on, let's go, quick. And like, okay, here's a little kind of like stress going on, but let's like see if we can find this mirror mind. And it's there. It's right there. In fact, that was the experience that actually gave rise to this question of, is this practice about being like happy and really relaxed? Or is it about being free? Because I don't feel like totally happy and relaxed now. But I feel there's some spacious freedom in this rushing anxiety, and I'm going to keep moving fast. But it's kind of like it's being held quite differently now with this mirror awareness. Another way to talk about the mirror is so our usually where our activity, our daily activity is being, I could say, hosted by like small self. Sort of like there's like our life is like a talk show, and the host is like the kind of reified small fixated I, me, self is hosting the show. Yeah, so how's it going? How's the talk going, Kokyo? Not so well. it's kind of like the commentator, sportscaster, host. And so that's hosting our experience. So we could talk about instead of like having the small self host our day, let the mirror host, be the host. I think the mirror actually is the host, but we don't give it much credit. We kind of take over the talk show. But the mirror is so gracious, it just says, so what? You can do that. We're not gonna, it's not like, the mirror doesn't have any power trips, right? It's not, okay, if you want to do that, Kokyo, if you want to run the show, go ahead. But I'll just watch from back here. So we might, like, you know, during Zazen or at a moment of stress, say, like, would you like to take over for a while? Mirror mind? You can host the next period of Zazen. Go ahead. You're already doing it, so like I might as well let you. another playing with this metaphor of the mirror. Sometimes we talk about the three turnings of the Dharma wheel. And this may be like a slight stretch of metaphor here, but the first turning of the Buddha's turning of the Dharma wheel is based on a strong emphasis on ethical conduct and very practical teachings, early teachings of the Buddha. Buddha's like, we need a really strong foundation here. So here's a bunch of precepts to practice, and here's a bunch of very practical teachings. And here's the virtuous practices and the non-virtuous practices. In the first turning of the teachings, that was one, to be brief, that was one emphasis. And we could say, that's like, the first turning is kind of like a cup. Like an empty cup. A nice container. And the second turning of the Buddha's teaching is like emphasizing emptiness. Where you can't grasp anything, you can't get a hold of anything, there's no fixed reference points. That's the way to be free from all the even ideas about the first turning. And we could say that's like kind of water poured into the cup. Clear water poured into the cup. I think if we just, you know, take away, pull out the rug of all reference points, just say, all dharmas are marked by emptiness without a strong foundation in ethics and other teachings. It doesn't work so well, actually. I think it's if we have this empty, clear, flowing water that just has no shape or form or color, if we just pour it on the ground, it just disperses everywhere. But if we pour it in this cup, of this container of practice, of virtue and kindness and many other practices, then we can actually, it kind of functions in there. And it doesn't all disperse and dry up on the ground. It stays like a nice cup of water, cup of clear water, and we let it be very still there. The surface of the water is very smooth, very much like a mirror. We could say that the empty mirror of the second turning is like this water poured into the cup. It just, the emptiness that when we look at, we can't directly, we can't see anything. And then the third turning, the Buddha's third turning of the Dharma wheel is teachings on Buddha nature. Many other ways to talk about this third turning, but Buddha nature, which the way that Dogen teaches, and some of you heard last year, is like very much about like Buddha nature manifests as all the appearances of the world. So in this image of the cup and the water, we could say the reflections on the surface of the water in the cup are like the third turning. Everything is reflected in there equally, right? But rather than the focus on the empty, clear water, the third turning may be emphasizing a little bit more the manifested reflections. Everything that we experience is like manifestations of Buddha nature. And it's merely reflections in the empty, clear water. But it's luminous, clear appearances. Like, here we are, is a little bit more like the third turning. Second turning, you look and you can't see anything at all. Third turning, it's like, here we are, but when we look what this is, it's just like reflections in this clear surface of the water that's held very nicely in the cup that keeps it very still and clear. So it's something that you can play with. It might fall apart a little bit, this metaphor of the cup, the water, and the reflections. But something to contemplate. So as I say, we have many Zen teachings on this mirror awareness, and we'll soon have in a couple weeks, we'll start a sesshin where we talk about polishing tiles to make mirrors, amongst other things. And then we have a class series on this dual mirror samadhi. But here's some excerpts from Chinese ancestor Baijiang, one of the great Tang Dynasty ancestors, Hyakujo in Japanese, known for many wonderful stories. Yeah. Maybe one of the most famous is he really liked to manifest his activity in around the temple and do a lot of gardening and painting and cleaning and fixing things up. And he got very old, and people said, he's just such a hard worker, we better, let's give him a break. But we keep telling him to take a break, but he won't. So let's hide his tools. And they did. The monks secretly hid all his work tools. And Baijiang said, well, if I can't work, then I'm not going to eat. He said, okay, we'll give you the tools back. And then became all over the land of China, the Zen saying, a day without work is a day without food. Coming from ancestor Baijiang. Zen emphasizes practical manifestation in the world. Rolling up the sleeves and getting to work. But recognizing that all these work tasks are just like reflections in a mirror. So, Baijiang one time said, he was actually, all through his record, he talks about mirror awareness. And it's, you know, Dzogchen's mirror samadhi, almost same thing, samadhi and awareness. It's a different Chinese character. Instead of saying samadhi, it's a character that means like illumination or awakeness or awareness or perception, like that. But the same mirror, right? Mirror awareness. He talks all through his record. So here's one part. He says, if the immediate mirror awareness, as of course, this mirror awareness is always immediately, right now and here. If the immediate mirror awareness is just not concerned by anything at all, if it just says, so what? The mirror says, so what? If it's not concerned by anything at all, existent or non-existent, and can pass through all kinds of stages as well as through all things, pleasant or unpleasant, then even if one hears of 100, 1,000, 10,000, or 100 million Buddhas appearing in the world, it's just as if one had not heard. So if suddenly like a million Buddhas appear like all around us, this mirror says, eh, so what? And if a million demons with fiery pitchforks appear all around us, eh, so what? It's just as if one had not even heard it all. Yet, one does not dwell in not hearing either. Like, I'm cool. So what? So cool. We can just say so what to a million Buddhas and a million demons. That's so what like. But not dwelling in that, like, how sweet, how wonderful. Just like I finally completely realized, so what? So what? It's like not dwelling in so what. One does not dwell in not hearing about these Buddhas, nor does one make an understanding of not dwelling. So, first there's kind of like saying, so what, like the mirror. And then there's like not dwelling in the so what, not dwelling, not sticking to a mirror awareness. Like, you know, like it's a little bit like, you know, by definition, the mirror awareness can't stick, but it might start to be like, yeah, I'm just reflecting everything equally. I'm feeling like really just so fine. And now, but like, you know, a little bit of that like blue, you know, just, no, just fine, cool. I think if we're actually dwelling in the mirror, it's a little bit like it's not actually operating as the mirror. But maybe it could be very, very subtle, like it's just reflecting everything equally, but there's just this kind of maybe self-complacency or like smugness or something about, yeah, I'm just being the mirror and like can't go wrong here. Kind of like Zen sickness, maybe, is dwelling in the mirror. Right? And then, okay, we're not even dwelling in the mirror. We're not stuck even there. But don't make an understanding of not dwelling in the mirror. It's kind of these three stages. You could say, that sounds very advanced. Let's just work on the mirror. And I think that's true. I think that's true, but it just shows the extent to which Bhajan is like, even if you really like feel like you, even just temporarily, or in Zazen maybe, feeling like, nothing can disturb the Zazen now. Someone could come and flip the ton over and be just fine. So what? Maybe right at that time, be like, am I dwelling there? Am I getting stuck there? And like, no, not dwelling. Like, I'm really okay about being upset if the ton gets flipped over. Therefore, I'm not dwelling in this really dispassionate mirror mind. But let's not make an understanding of non-dwelling or non-abiding. Like, I understand what Bhajan's talking about. Don't make an understanding. A conceptual understanding, I think, is really what he's talking about. to speak of the mirror awareness is still not really right. So please excuse me. We're going to spend the rest of the year being not quite right. By way of the impure, discern the pure. In other words, by way of talking about the mirror awareness, which is a little bit impure to talk about, you can discern the pure. And maybe some advantage of impurity. Otherwise, there would be no Dharma teaching. Right? If you say the immediate mirror awareness is correct, or that there is something else beyond the mirror awareness, this is all delusion. We're specifically talking about speaking and ideas about mirror awareness. If you say, it's perfect, that practice includes everything, it's like, it's correct. Mirror awareness is Buddha mind. Correct. No, that's delusion. But if you say, well, maybe there's something more than this mirror awareness, it's not the whole story, right? That's not correct either. This is all delusion. If you keep dwelling in the immediate mirror awareness, this too is the same as delusion. It's called the mistake of naturalism. Naturalism. We do say, you know, just be natural. But we don't want to, like, take up the religion of naturalism, which is like dwelling in being natural. Kind of a nice word in English. Naturalism. To say that the present mirror awareness is one's own Buddha is words of measurement, words of calculation. It's like the crying of a jackal. This is still being stuck as in glue at the gate. We're about to pass through the gate, but right before the gate there's all this glue on the ground. Whoop! Our feet are stuck. Originally, you did not acknowledge that innate knowing and awareness are your own Buddha, and you went running elsewhere to seek Buddha. So you needed a teacher to tell you about innate knowing and awareness as a medicine to cure this disease of hastily seeking outside. Once you no longer seek outwardly, the disease is cured, and it's necessary to remove the medicine. If you cling fixedly to innate knowing awareness, this is a disease of meditation. Meditation sickness. The Dogen essay that we're going to study in this upcoming sesshin is called The Acupuncture Needle of Zazen, or it could be translated as The Acupuncture Needle for Zazen. It's like there's, for Zazen sickness, Dogen offers this acupuncture needle to, like, sometimes the sickness is very, like, you can pinpoint it. It's very subtle. So you don't just, like, you don't just, go in with a huge scalpel and gouge out the whole thing. Illness of Zazen. Because Zazen illness is not like that. You just use it, like, the finest acupuncture needle to cure Zazen. And I think this is the kind of disease that Baijiang's talking about. When the disease is cured of seeking outside, it could be quite a subtle disease, then you need to remove the medicine. If you cling fixedly to innate knowing awareness, this is a disease of meditation. So what? Any questions? Comments? Or expressions? Reflections? Yes.
I've been reading, sort of absorbing Martin Luther King lately for
understanding the so what as unattachment and how important that is for even, let's say, being successful in every endeavor you do. I always feel like, and I know it's understood, but I still always feel like the commitment to righteous action has to go hand in hand with it.
With so what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that when we hear the suffering of the child or we see injustice, we have to act. But we also say so what?
Yeah, yeah, those two together. That's what's nice about the image of the cup with the water.
That's why that's the image of the cup.
Mm-hmm, yeah. It's like, if we just say, so what, like the suffering child or something, yeah, so what, I think that's when the water just spills all over the sidewalk and evaporates. But if we're totally committed to bodhisattva conduct, and you know, it's the beautiful way to relate to reflections is with compassion and kindness. So they naturally go together while still seeing the reflection, reflected kind of illusory aspect of that child. We have many Zen sayings like this, like the Diamond Sutra is the, has the, I think, classic bodhisattva instructions, right? I think right near the beginning, Subhuti here, one of those disciples asked, is it Subhuti?
Uh-huh.
Asked the Buddha, how does a bodhisattva act? How does a bodhisattva train their mind and live in this world? You know, this is, I'm sort of paraphrasing. Maybe some of you read this on New Year's Day, the Diamond Sutra. I found there was a reading here. And something like, all beings, no matter how many there are, of all different kinds, and Buddha even gets specific, like, are the modes of birth, whether they're born from eggs or wombs, or from moisture, like insects, or spontaneously born spirits, you know, like, let's not leave any sentient beings out. No matter how many there are of all these kinds, the bodhisattva vows to save them, to free them all from suffering, and not just a little bit, but vows to carry them to the other shore of Buddhahood. And you kind of get this thing like, wow, that's huge. And then it kind of like the end of the sentence. But the Buddha says, the Bodhisattva, while arousing this vow, sees that there are no beings. All these kind of beings he just listed, vow to save them while understanding and realizing that there are no beings to save. So, empty, totally empty, mere reflections in the empty mirror, and yet, this is our world of reflections. Yes.
It's like this, the attitude with which you would do those kinds of actions. That, you know, we live in a relative world. We act, you know, we see the suffering. We move to try to relieve it. But we're informed by no sense of subject and object. Because if we are, then it becomes dualistic. It's like, oh, you poor thing over there, I'm going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you poor thing. Well, maybe they're helping me.
Yeah.
I'm the poor thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're the poor thing, but I'm the poor thing, you know. So if we can take these actions with this sort of just, not so what, like, I don't care, but so what as in, I'm not so great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't get too caught up in what a great, you know, activist I am, or what a great savior I am. Do the work.
Yeah.
Others respond. But just hold it with that sort of, you know, big mind.
I think another way to apply so what to these engaged situations is in regards to the outcome. So it's like we're totally engaged in it, but like whether it works or not, you know, Martin Luther King had to deal with this stuff all the time, right? You just do the work and it doesn't work. It's like, oops, it failed. I wholeheartedly offered my best and it was rejected and it didn't work. That's when we say, so what? Right?
And then you keep going.
And then you keep going, yeah. You have to keep going because we're alive. Yeah. So, kind of introduction to mirror awareness, and I think you know, whether you're brand new to meditation or have been practicing for many decades, this mirror awareness way of talking about zazen or meditation, I think really is accessible to everybody. Some of those details from Bhagyan might sound kind of like, you know, the non-dwelling and not making an understanding might sound a little tricky, but the basic thing of you're sitting and all kinds of stuff's coming up, you know, just kind of like step back or just fall back while still staying upright. Let your mind fall back into this kind of like the host of reflecting mirror awareness that's just like, you can kind of open to that part of your mind that's really okay with what's happening, even at the same time that the little small self is totally caught up in something. That's part of the miracle here, is that they can be simultaneous. It's not that this mirror awareness obliterates the stress and there's suddenly like nothing happening. Simultaneous. We say the horse arrives before the donkey leaves. We dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to the complete, perfect awakening of all living beings. May they realize their luminous mirror wisdom right at the same time as their petty concerns arise and cease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.